Welcome to this, the Nerdist Podcast, number 279. I am nervously excited. My very first comedy special, Mandroid, airs Saturday, November 10th at 11 p.m. 10 Central on Comedy Central. It's an hour long of stand-up. And I don't think it sucks. I actually think it's pretty good. I hope that's not foolish, but I hope you like it. So please watch it. It would be huge if you did. And then I'll be performing on the road after that. So go to Nerdist.com/calendar and check that business out. Or if you're listening to this podcast ages after November 10th, maybe it's available somewhere that you could then go watch it. I would like to thank, for this week's sponsor of the Nerdist Podcast, Stamps.com. No more wasting time with the post office. But then you might be like, well, what if I just got myself one of those postage meters? You would be foolhardy, my friend. A word that doesn't get used enough. You have more features than you could possibly ever want at Stamps.com at a fraction of the price of a postal meter. Plus, you get special discounts on mailing and shipping that you can't even get at the post office on things like Priority Mail and Express Mail. Stamps.com is the way to go, especially if you're going to run a small business out of your home. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com right now. Use the promo code Nerdist to get a special offer of a no-risk trial, $110, plus of bonus stuff like a digital scale, free postage. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click the microphone at the top of the homepage. Type in Nerdist. You're going to get a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. That is Stamps.com. Post haste! Post. Hey, that's like a post office. Well, words. This episode is Kevin Bacon, and he was fucking awesome. We went to, when we were in New York for New York Comic Con and our live podcast, we went to a studio where he's shooting his new show. It's called The Following. It's a mid-season replacement on Fox. So it'll be on early next year. Super cool show. It's kind of Silence of the Lambsy. So Joan and I went to the studio where they shoot this and just sat in Kevin's trailer and had a conversation with Kevin Bacon, who was awesome. And unfortunately, Matt couldn't be there because he took a red eye the night before and he got a little sick. And we had to make sure he was in good health for the podcast we were doing that night at the Best Buy Theater. So sorry, no Matt Myra, but I trade your Myra for a Kevin Bacon. Huh? Nerdist Podcast episode 279 with Kevin Bacon. I think actually listening to this podcast reduces your bacon number, so enjoy that.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Thank you for having us in your trailer.
Yeah, thanks. I'm sorry it's not a nicer trailer.
No, this is a perfect...
No. Apology accepted.
No, for this is like the size of a New York apartment, so this actually feels all right to me.
Yeah, okay, good.
It might actually be bigger than a New York apartment.
Well, it's bigger than my first apartment for sure.
Yeah. When did you move out to New York?
I moved to New York in 1976. From Philadelphia, and my first apartment was my sister's couch because she had a place here on 76th and West End, and then I moved into a place called the Breton Hall, which I found I had $150. That's what I decided my budget was for month rent. And it was, you know, hard finding a place.
With the 150?
Even in 76, I was thinking like, oh, in 76 you could live somewhere for $10.
Yeah. No, but it was still hard. And I saw in the back of the Village Voice there was a ad that said, actors, dancers, musicians... high-rise artist residence. So I went to this place, and it was basically a flop house. I mean, it really was. It was kind of a, you know, what we called an SRO, a single room occupancy. And they had a rental office, and I said, I have $150 to spend. And the guy said, well, we do have rooms for $150, but they're called one bedrooms, which is basically one room, and you used a bathroom down the hall that the entire, you know, floor used.
Yeah.
And they said, well, we don't have any available, but we do have quote unquote two bedrooms available. And the two bedroom was a kitchen and a bedroom.
Okay.
Actually, they did have a bathroom, and they were three and a quarter. So half of that, you know, I was going to jump past my limit a little bit, but I figured, okay, that'll be okay. But I said to the guy, I don't have a roommate. I don't have anybody to live with. And he said, well, what about this guy? And there was this guy sitting next to me in the office. We were on his couch, I'll never forget. And he looked at me, and he said, what do you think? And I said, all right. What do you think? Yeah, and we, like, in that second, moved in together, lived together for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
I don't know anything about this dude. I mean, I don't know his name. I don't know anything. And he turned out to be a great guy. His name was Mark Mitchell, and he was a classical pianist. And we looked at the space, and I said, okay, I'll sleep in the kitchen. And he took the bedroom. And he took the... excuse me.
Sure.
Beautiful. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And he bought a grand piano into it.
Oh Jesus! Oh.
Yeah, and it basically took up most of the room. I'm trying to think if his bed actually kind of sat, you know, underneath the piano.
Did you sleep under the piano?
Well, I did sometimes. We had a bat problem.
A bat problem?
Yeah. And on the night when the bat came in, I was, you know, I didn't want to sleep in my room because the bat was in my room.
Crime is a new enemy.
Batman, please.
Would it just open up the window and, like, where did it come
squeak,
from?
It was
squeak,
the craziest.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the craziest thing, man. We one night, I just woke up. And I turned on the light, and there's a fucking bat flying around my room. And I went slamming into Mark's room, and I was like, I don't think I said dude. I don't think we said dude. I said,
Fellow.
Sir.
Ahoy there.
Yeah. There's a bat. And it was such a comedy of errors that night trying to get this bat out of the room was, I mean, the first thing I did was I called, you know, pest control, like that. There was like a city number, poison control or something like that, because I was afraid of like what would get hit, you know, happen if you get bit by a bat. And they were like, you have a what, sir? A bat? I don't know. They were like, no, we don't need it. Yeah.
But it's a bat.
No, sir, that's too scary. I'm
sorry. I like to think that you're running around trying to catch the bat, and then Mark sits down at the piano and starts going...
That would have been great, actually.
No, not a rat, a bat.
Oh, guys, I forgot to tell you, guy rented out, you got a third roommate. It's a bat. Yeah. And he's going to sleep with the piano.
Yeah.
We actually... put on at one point we're in his room, locked in his room, and we're trying to figure out ways to do it. And at one point he said, I'm going in with a broom, but he didn't want to have any kind, it was the middle of summer, but he didn't want to have any kind of exposed skin, so I put on like a, you know, a what do you call those things, like a they got a name, that they did,
like a jumpsuit,
no, where you, with the eyes are cut out, like a woolen mask.
Oh, yeah.
Ski mask. Yeah. A ski mask and a coat and giant rubber boots, and he had a broom, and I opened the door and slammed it behind him, and I hear it, and then he's like swinging around. Couldn't get rid of the bat. Then we came up with the idea. Somehow I remembered from someplace that they are attracted to shiny objects if it's dark. So the apartment was like on an air shaft. So you had windows that were sort of, I guess, you know, perpendicular to each other. And one was in my room, one was in his room. So we took a tennis racket and attached a coat hanger to it to extend it out, and took a ball of of what's funny?
This is ball. Very elaborate.
We took a ball of tin foil, you know, aluminum foil, and put it on the end of the coat hanger, and we were hanging out over the thing, like dangling this fucking thing out the window, like, "Here, come on, come on, you're gonna love this." Look at and of course, it did absolutely. It had nothing. It was useless. I mean, you know. Anyway, make a long story short, that we, I slept. The reason I thought of it is that I slept under the piano.
Oh, it's just because of the bed.
Yeah, because I didn't want to sleep in bed with Mark, and I didn't want to sleep in my room because I was afraid of, you know, afraid of the bat. So
yeah, rabies.
Yeah, so I woke up the next day and he was gone.
Oh, that's such a sad. Sir. No note. He just left. He wasn't there anymore.
Your roommate left, right?
Yeah, my roommate. Yes,
he's gone.
And that's when I know these bats of yours. Yeah. You know, first when you started telling the story about how you met this guy, I thought it was gonna be like, and that guy turned out to be Tom Hanks or whatever. Like it sounds like the two young actors.
Do you?
No, he's a beautiful, beautiful piano player.
You still know?
I've run into him a couple of times, but we're not really in touch too much. Ended up working. I think he works at Lincoln Center maybe now, doing something like these. He's an accompanist.
Oh, wow.
And nice. It was kind of magical because, you know, as you know, as horrible as the apartment was, I mean, it was really, really badly roach infested. I mean, just a horrible, horrible roach problem that I could not seem to get rid of because there was a garbage dump that was kind of adjacent to my wall where I slept, so I always figured that they would roaches would go over there for dinner and come over to our place for dancing afterwards.
Hey, that's where all the bats are going.
This is probably
going
to hit Kevin's again.
But his playing was just spectacular, and he would have to practice, and he would practice really hard on really, really complicated classical pieces. You know, he wasn't like a boogie woogie player. You know, he's like a real serious player. And
were you playing music at the same time?
I was playing a little bit.
Out and about, or just
no, I wasn't playing out at all. No, yeah. No, that didn't happen until quite a bit later. Mm. But I always, you know, loved music, and I'd been writing songs and stuff. Although we never really, you know, kind of worked on music together.
No late night jam sessions.
No.
You should just for fun track him down. And just send him like a rubber bat in a box, and then just send it to him and see if it sparks. Don't put your name on anything, and just see if it sparks anything.
I'd love this. I'd love to someday download with him about, you know, just his memories, because that's just one story. There was a lot of stuff that crazy stuff that happened there. He worked at the Copacabana, which was kind of cool, and he wouldn't get home until like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning.
Jeez.
You know, I was working as a waiter too and going to acting school, but I didn't work quite as late as him.
What was New York like in the 70s? I mean, I was alive in the 70s, but I just, everything to me about New York just feels like Serpico or something. It's just like everything, yeah. Just like, ah, it's
dirty.
It's kind of dirty and dingy, and the streets are hard, and yeah. Like it's sort of,
yeah. Yeah, it's great when you look at those movies, those great movies in the 70s, right, that really kind of captured, you know, New York, Scorsese stuff, and then, you know, but it's like everything from that to you know, the Bronson movies, right?
Yeah.
That's, you know, that they were really, it was really thought of as a super, super dirty, dangerous place to be.
Did you feel scared? Like, was it dangerous?
Well, I'll tell you, I grew up in Philly. So, honestly, coming to New York, I felt way safer.
Yeah.
It's just I don't know, it was so alive, and everybody was there, and everyone was on the street, and it just never seemed to close down. And no, I didn't, I mean, in comparison now, yeah, sure, it certainly was, you know, I mean, I got robbed at gunpoint, you know.
Really?
Yeah. But And then once broken into in an apartment, you know, a guy was, you know, with a screwdriver and, you know, stuff like that. So, Yeah, I mean, it definitely. But at the time, you know, you're younger. You don't have kids, so you're not really thinking. Your perception of danger. You are the kid. You know what I mean? It's like not. It's sort of not the same. But I loved it. I mean, I loved New York in the 70s. I loved the just. You know, it was so electric for me, and I didn't go to college, so I was 17 when I got here. So, you know, it was a great. It was my where I grew up in a lot of ways.
Do you think young performer needs that kind of experience of like I'm living in a closet with insects and just like I don't know, does it build character, or do you think it's important? Do you think it's important in some way? Or
I think that everyone's path is different. You know. I think everyone's path is different, and I wouldn't have traded it myself, you know. But do I think you have to have that to be able to be good? No, I mean, no, I really don't. You can grow up as a musketeer and be good.
Yeah. But does it give you an appreciation for everything that's happened since?
Totally.
More so than a kid that started up.
Like, yeah, I mean, oh boy, I appreciate everything that's happened since. There is no doubt about that, man. I'm very, very grateful, very appreciative. And also, I think that, I mean, I feel like, listen, I don't think it's, you know, sometimes I think this can sound a little, what's the word? Precious or something like that, but I feel like in the course of your life as an actor, you're going to be called upon to play a lot of different kinds of people, and the exposure all throughout my childhood and through my years in New York that I've gotten to different kinds of people by just being in the city, you know, has been really formative in terms of like the kinds of, you know, roles that I feel I can sort of embrace. Yeah. You know, I have a buddy who's playing he's in New York, and he's playing a New York City cop, and he said to me the other day, you know, he's living in Queens because he's from out of town, and did I say he was from New York?
No.
Yeah, he's from out of town. He has to play New York City cop, and he went and looked at an apartment in Dumbo, which at this point is a very, very kind of high-end. And he went, you know, I can't be there. I need to be surrounded at this point in my life with this park by cops and firemen. You know what I mean? Because that's what I'm being asked to do right now. And I think that for some people, for some actors, that can be really valuable. And it certainly was for me.
I never thought about that.
I really just felt like the city just it continues to feed me, like all the time, in terms of who I'm gonna play.
I guess there's really no other city in America where you can go and get this kind of a cross section of human beings in such a concentrated area.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of comics, like, you know, like that have like come to LA end up wanting to go back to New York because, like, you know, they think of more stuff, like, well, you know, writers and stuff like that. I mean, I think just like walking around the city, you're just constantly stimulated by a you know, bevy of things.
Well, Los Angeles is a very isolating experience because you're in your car by yourself. Everything is very intentional. You have to mean to go places. You rarely stumble across. I mean, like, doing comedy in New York is a better experience than just having to do it in LA. But
I think you have to also, as you get successful, it becomes very easy to isolate yourself even more, right? Because, you know, it's kind of can be, whether perceived or real, it can kind of become sort of a hassle to be around and, you know, whatever, signing pictures and, you know, taking pictures and signing or shit like that. You know, so people tend to, with success comes a certain level of cloistering in a way,
sure,
I think.
Sure.
And then there also comes this kind of strange move to spend more time with people who are as successful as you.
Sure.
You know what I mean? or you know what I mean? Just kind of like that's who you're, the people that you're with, it makes you feel, you know what I mean? It's like a weird thing. I mean, I say this because, you know, I have in the past or at times in my life found myself, you know, seduced by that, those concepts and that sort of feeling, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that that can be a mistake, because I think that you can really start to lose touch with the people that you are really asked to portray. And I am never asked, or rarely asked, to portray a movie star. You know what I mean? If I am, it's great. I love it. It's hilarious. It's great. The times when I've been able to either play an actor or play myself or something like that, I'm like, yeah, this is fucking great. I love it. It's a walk in the park. But it's rare that that happens.
Kevin, we want you to play a multi-millionaire who sits atop a throne of society.
Oh, well, all right. I have this very fancy group of friends.
I used to work at MTV, and I interviewed you in like 1995 at the Video Music Awards. And I'm not going to make you talk about this a lot, because I'm sure you're over it. But the game that bears your name, I mentioned it to you, and you're like, ah, I don't know. And I'm like, oh yeah, but it's awesome. You go, I just feel like people are making fun of me, and I go, no, they're celebrating this amazing. And this was in '95,
yeah.
And even at that point, you had an incredible body of work. Just from the apartment with the bat, just up to 1995. Mm-hmm. And then that's been 17 years, and then that's just continued to happen since then. So I'm glad that, from what I've read, you have embraced the idea, finally, and your charity is named after
it. 6degrees.org, we launched probably 2002, maybe 2003, something like that, I can't remember exactly. And that's been good, because it's been a way to... Well, I mean, it's even without the 6 degrees idea, just something for me to kind of focus, you know, my to focus some of the frustration that I feel with the things that I read in the paper and in the news and stuff like that. You know, kind of the overwhelming feeling that you get when you pick up the paper and there's so much shit that's going wrong and so many things that. So many people that need help and so many causes and whatever, just to be able to take that, you know, idea of 6 degrees and channel it into something that I can feel positive about, you know. I think that it was such a natural fit too, because I really, you know, I'm sure maybe you haven't heard me say this before, but if you take me out of the game, which really was the idea of 6degrees.org, the concept is a beautiful concept, that we are all connected, that the things that you do in your neighborhood down the, you know, affect people down the street around the world, you know what I mean? It's like there's this chain, and we did all crawl out of the same swamp. You can't you can't make acid rain in one town and believe that it's just going to go up there and, you know, just rain down on you right here. You know what I mean? It's gonna make its way across the country. I mean, you know, there's fallout from, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on that shows the interconnectedness of people and of human beings, and that's kind of the idea behind 6 degrees, especially if you take me out of it.
How did you remain just sort of a normal guy who was able to, like, you know, stay in a long-term relationship and also not be seduced by all of the fancy stuff, and just, like, what is it just, like, because you're still a Philly guy at heart? Like, what is it?
I don't really know. I mean, I think that, I guess, maybe it's a value system that my parents gave me and my brothers and sisters, you know, that says that at some point in life you have to find something other than your own success that's more important to you than that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, my father was like a very, very, he was a very, in his world, he was a very successful guy. He wasn't a rich guy, never turned it into anything, you know, monetary. But he was a urban planner and extremely active in Philadelphia, and really, really, extremely drawn to the limelight. Really, really, in a deep, deep way, wanted the fame and wanted to be known and wanted to be seen, and really, really, kind of embraced that. And I think that I got a healthy part of that from him, you know, to say the least. because I think that a lot of what kind of drove me in my, like, the fame thing was to be more famous than my father, or at least the way that I perceived my father to be in Philadelphia. But hand in hand with that, I was often sort of horrified at how much it meant to him, even as a kid. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That I could see that it was so paramount to him, you know, and whatever his perceived idea of success was like on such a pedestal, and I saw that, you know, in his last years, you know, kind of, you know, trying to hold on to it, and it affected me to the point where I went, well, you know, it's great, and it certainly is an acknowledgement of trying to do your best sort of work when you get famous or you're in a magazine or you get to do a podcast or
of course. Well, thank you for the last one. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean,
whatever.
This must be the crowning jewel.
Yes. Here I am.
So, Mark, someday I'm going to be in a podcast. What's that? I don't know. Get that bat out of here.
But, you know, I also thought to myself, it's at some point you have to find something that's bigger than your own budget, and you know, that's all I know, and that becomes, you know, family and kids and, you know, relationships, friendship.
The fame thing is weird because it just the small brush that I've ever had with it, it just, there's a moment where you're like, hey, this means I did something right, and then it just goes away immediately, and then there's that, how am I supposed to get more of this? Yeah. Like, it's like a weird, you know, I guess humans are sort of addicted to attention. Maybe it's a biological thing, like, oh, if I'm ahead of the tribe, then I'll be good for breeding. Or, like, there must be some sort of a biological reason that we crave it.
That comes into a lot of play where it's like you talk to people about what is success, and, you know, some people will, like, remember when he was successful? It's like, well, the guy still works and still makes a lot of money, but, like, he's not famous. And so it's weird where people perceive fame and just being in the eye
especially
as
now.
Success. Yeah, exactly.
Especially now when that's the only thing that a lot of people want.
And it's weird because it's like, you know, you could see, like, an actor that's just a guy that just works. Again, like, it's like he's successful. He's a successful actor, but nobody knows who he is. And it's like, well, he's not successful. So success is fame.
Right.
You know, that's the weird mind trip that can happen, I think, to a lot of people. Where it's like, you know, like, what are you talking about? You own a house, you've been working as, like, in your own art form. And, like, I think that's a thing that a lot of people forget is that you need to, like, if you're just working at what you want to do as an artist, that's success. Yeah. As opposed to just people knowing who you are.
Completely, man. I remember when I was doing regional theater, and I had had this idea of success, which was to be on the cover of, like, Tiger Beat.
Did that ever happen?
Never happened.
What?
I don't know. I think it sort of went. I don't know.
Tiger Beat, it's time.
Yeah. Is there still a time?
I don't know.
There's got to be something.
Or like, Big Bopper. Kevin Bacon on the cover.
Talk about dating yourself. But so all of a sudden, then I started doing theater, and I'd be out in some, you know, regional theater in Louisville or Massachusetts or wherever I was, and, you know, there'd be an actor who was an incredible actor and who went from job to job to job and had, you know, had just done Chekhov, now was doing this play and was on his way to do, you know, Richard III. And I was like, okay, so I have to completely redefine my ideas of what success is. And the day that you, as you said, don't have to wait tables, you know, and you're actually making a living being, well, if you're an independent contractor, you know, in some form,
yeah,
that's a really successful thing, because that's a really hard thing to have to get to. The other thing I believe is that people really tend to focus on the negative sides of fame. Fame, one of the cool things about fame is, like, all day long, people are nice to you. For, like, things that you don't even deserve. You know? Like, they say, serve, and they give you free shit, and they, you know what I mean? They, and a lot of times they'll, like, come up and say, I love you. Like people will wait their whole lives to have somebody come up and tell them that they love them. You know what I mean? So it is incredibly addictive. And to be able to walk away from it or give it up is a very hard thing to do. And that's why I believe that you'll see people who will become less famous, and they will find any way to get back into the fame thing.
Really?
Even
television.
Even if it's like something where you go, really? What? I mean, why the fuck are you doing that?
Yeah.
Or even like, to end up, I don't know, in rehab or you know, just do some kind of wacky ass thing, you know?
I don't have a drinking problem, but I just wanted to go on celebrity rehab because I seem to get back on television.
Well, it's because they're missing the endorphins they got from people seeing them and being happy.
Oh, I'm curious about this. Was your, when you started to get really successful, which happened, seemed like it happened pretty quickly, was your dad cool with it, or was he like, oh no, that's great, that's great?
No, he was cool with it. He was very, very supportive, extremely supportive. Both of my parents were. You know, I mean, I'm the youngest of six kids, so, you know, I often say that they didn't even notice when I left home. I went to them, you know, when I was in high school and said, I'm going to New York, I'll see you later, I'm going to become an actor. And there was no part of them that said, well, you know, what about college or da-da-da. They just were like, good, you're going to do great, and came to see everything I was in, you know, saw every piece of shit I ever did, and would write, you know, long letters, especially my father would write these long letters about my performances and just awful, you know, kinds of movies and stuff like that. No, he was extremely, I mean, I think he was extremely supportive, and I mean, he, you know, that's a kind of fame in itself, right? If your offspring is famous. I don't think he was threatened by it.
Oh, good. That's cool.
So he didn't have like he didn't want to act or be an actor.
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
No. It's not that hard what you do up there.
No, he was not. Well, I mean, he liked public speaking, and he liked to be, you know, in the limelight, and was, towards the end of his life was extremely, sort of, you know, cantankerous and controversial, and would, you know, even into his 90s would find ways into the newspaper and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He one of the really great things that he did was in his 90s in Philadelphia, there was a park called Love Park.
Yeah.
Which, if you're a skater, is kind of a legendary skate park.
Yeah.
And there's that L-O-V-E, you know, that's that
yep.
famous mm-hmm. thing. So they have one of those there. And it was just a place where you could, where skaters loved to grind, because there were these kind of like, some of the benches were just made out of concrete, and you could jump on them, and there's a whole series of steps and stuff like that. So it became known as Love Park, and it was actually, you know, a major like skate destination, even for people from across the country would come to Philly
there was like most of the videos I watched always had like a portion at that park.
Right.
Yeah.
So they banned the skaters from Love Park, and my father went fucking ballistic. He believed that the use of public space should be used by anybody, especially the skaters.
Wow.
And that the what little damage that they were doing to the park was a small trade off for having it alive and being used. And he went and tried to get arrested. I don't think they arrested him by skateboarding, man.
90-year-old man.
They put a helmet on him and basically lifted him onto the skateboard and dragged him like, you know, like 4 or 5 feet.
That's so sweet.
You could probably see a video of it, I think. And it was just great. I mean, you know, and he chained himself to trees that he didn't want taken down. You know,
that's really awesome.
He was crazy.
So what? How did Animal House happen? Was that a did
I was in Circle in the Square acting school, which I'm still there, and I was in my first year. It was a 2-year program, and they sent the casting director over there. He, I guess uncharacteristically, you know, usually you know, actors are submitted by agents and all. And I guess Landis wanted to see if he could find maybe some kids or college age kids that didn't have agents, so they weren't like actors, you know.
Sure.
Anyway, said, do you have any preppy freshmen wet behind the ears? And they sent me over. And I walked in, and John Landis was there, and he said, there was very little for me to read. I mean, there was a couple of lines, you know, but I read it. One of the funny things was that he said, can you do that? Make a smarmy face. Smarmy. Make a smarmy face. And I was like, I had no idea what smarmy meant, but it's kind of like a onomatopoeia.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So I just kind of did, you know, I don't know, I made some face, right? He's like, that's great. I love that. That's great. Let's see it. And then
knowing Max, that's even funnier.
Yeah.
And then he, who's Max?
His son.
Oh, his son.
Who very much talks that way, like, hey, like, yeah, he very much has it.
Yeah. And then I went back, I guess, and did it again. Smarty, you know. And then the guy called me, in my apartment, you know, where the bat was, and. He said, you got the part in Animal House. And I was like, oh my God, you're kidding me. He goes, yeah, it's going to be 7 weeks or something like that. You're going to get scale. I said, oh my God. I didn't know what scale was. It's not that I didn't know how much it was. I didn't know what the word meant.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, great, I'll get a scale. That's good. He said, but you know, we need you out here like by Monday or something like that. And I was like, yeah, but I just dropped my laundry at the Fluff and Fold, and you know, I got a date. And he's like, no, you don't understand, it's not like that, you gotta get on a plane. So that's how it happened.
So I never got my laundry back, and spoke to that girl again.
And never spoke to the girl.
How was it? What was it like to work on the set? Like, how was John to work with?
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, the first experience was that I'd never flown first class before. So I was completely amazed that the alcohol was free. And that it was unlimited amounts of alcohol. So I got completely trashed on the way out there and tried to talk the flight attendant into... I had to stop in San Francisco for the night. Tried to talk her into, you know, staying with me. And part of my technique was by flashing my script around. It was like a major motion.
Don't you know this is Animal House? This is going to change the way teen comedies are done.
Yeah. And I remember that, you know, she was very sweet. It was like, you know, you're dreaming. And but she did give me, as I was leaving the plane, the remainder of a bottle of Amaretto. I had ordered Amaretto because I felt that Amaretto was a classy sort of after dinner drink, you know. And to this day, I mean, I can't even look.
How sick did you get?
Let alone smell Amaretto. So the next day, I woke up and flew from San Francisco up to Oregon, and rushed me onto the set, into hair and makeup and wardrobe, cut my hair all off. I had long hair at the time. And the costumer, I remember, was furious at me because they had called to ask for my sizes and I had got them all wrong. and so none of the clothes that they had for me fit. And as it turned out, I didn't work that day, and then I didn't work for a week because, I don't know, just the schedule and, you know, whatever. So that was a big sort of learning experience, because I was really, like, amped up and, here I go, you know what I mean? And then I ended up not working. Sat in my hotel room. Just a hotel kind of like by the side of the freeway, and waited. And eventually I started to meet some of the other cast. But what was kind of weird about the Animal House experience, as great as it was to, you know, do a movie at all and be in my first movie, was that I guess John probably purposely, although I don't know if I've ever really spoken to him about this, kind of wanted to create a separation between the Deltas and the Omegas. And he had brought all the Animal House guys out early, and they had all had this kind of like super bonding kind of experiences where they'd gone out into bars and they'd gotten into fights, and they'd they were like friends like immediately, because that's what he really wanted. And the rest of us were completely pushed aside.
Oh, wow.
So that would be, Niedermeyer, yeah. And I don't know, whoever else, me and whoever else was part of the, the losing, yeah, kind of side of things. So those guys would have these amazing, like, parties in the hotel and stuff, and we were not invited. And as a young guy, I was like, I want to be part of the crowd, I want to feel this kind of sense of camaraderie. It was the kind of camaraderie that I felt, kind of in the theater that I had done up until that point, and that I felt with my colleagues in acting school. And I think that acting to me, in a lot of ways, I sort of looked at as kind of like a brotherhood, that has since, in a lot of ways, just gone completely out the window, I think. Especially in movies, it's very hierarchical, and, anyway, that's a whole other topic. But so, while it was fun, and I made it fun, there were times when, I felt kind of, just kind of pushed out.
Yeah.
So once you got the college experience from doing that movie, wanting to be part of the cool kids, and
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right about that. And in fact, I tried to kind of get the college experience while I was there, because I would meet people on the set. Guys would be like extras and stuff like that. And I had two friends. One that was from an Animal House. I went to a party, and it was as wild as the fucking movie. I mean, it was like completely insane and just rampant, drug use and all that kind of stuff. I'm talking about a real frat.
Yeah.
And then I went to another one where I had some holes in my jeans, and they were like, you really shouldn't. So I really got I got both of those experiences.
Yeah. So you didn't really get to hang out with Belushi that much.
Well, Belushi and I, the only real scene, I guess, maybe that we sort of have is when he spit the mashed potatoes on.
Right.
But I really liked John. He wasn't really part of that. He was on a whole other trip. Partly because, I don't know if you know this, but he was doing the show, doing SNL at the same time that he was doing Animal House. So he was flying back and forth from Oregon. He would shoot like 2 or 3 days in Oregon, then go back and do SNL, and then jump back on a plane and do the same thing. He did that week after week after week. So that was, really hard. But he was an incredibly... after the movie, throughout those, those next years after the movie, I would run into him sometimes in New York, either at, nightclubs or even... There was like a little deli down in the Village. Sometimes we would, see each other. He was unbelievably sweet guy, and gentle and funny and nice, and I'm sure he had that kind of crazy side to him, but he also had another really just a very nice, generous kind of side. I remember he had a I guess he had a house or an apartment or something like that, and he had one day a brunch for everybody. That one I was invited to. And he had brought out smoked salmon from, you know, some deli in New York, and bagels and you know, cream cheese and lox and stuff like that. And I knew how much, you know, lox cost, because like in my world that would be to get lox on the bag would be like a giant, you know, windfall. You'd have to have a windfall, and here was like piles of it, and I thought, wow, that is one rich dude. He was able to roll.
He's lox rich.
Much. Yeah, lox rich. Yeah, but he was cool.
So you must have felt so. Then coming off Animal House, and then a couple years later, Diner must have been the camaraderie experience that you wanted
oh, yeah.
to have.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And do you think that's part of why that movie was such a defining film of its era? Because it really just felt like these are best friends, and this is their... That's us! That's me! Oh, he's that guy! I'm that guy!
Yeah, I do. I think that was it. I mean, probably both movies, you know, were an example of that idea really working. You know, I mean, I this idea that of forcing chemistry into something is in some ways I find it a little insulting to the actor, because it sort of assumes that I can't act well enough to act that somebody is my best friend, or that I want to sleep with them, or that they're my father, or whatever. Yeah. You know, we need to have this idea of chemistry. I don't really believe in that word. I think it's like a chemistry is just two actors that are acting well, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And pretending, you know, to do whatever it is. That being said, on Diner, very similar kind of thing, where Barry brought us down and we really did hang out, and most of us were, you know, we were kind of at the same point in our lives, in that we were unfettered to a certain extent, and some of us had little tastes of fame, you know, maybe... you know, Mickey had done some stuff, and you know, I'd been on Soap and done Animal House, but nobody was like a real star. It wasn't like we couldn't just go out someplace and be anonymous. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the time that we hung out together, I think, really did have a very positive sort of impact on the movie. If nothing else, I mean, there was a lot of improvising that the rest of the guys did that, you know, ended up in the film.
Oh wow.
Was that the movie that changed everything, or was it Footloose?
You know, I really think of it all as baby steps, even Footloose. I mean, Footloose certainly was a big, you know, kind of explosion, but I don't really ever attribute it just to one thing. It always seems like, you know, you say to yourself, if I could only get, you know, an agent. And then you get an age, like, ah, oh, that's it. You know, yeah. I could only, you know, so Animal House was the first movie. Great, I got into a movie. I came back and I ended up waiting tables for another like 3 years after that. You know what I mean? So I was like, I'm in a movie. I had to ask for the night off to go to the premiere. You know what I mean? But, you know, I kept chipping away, and then you kind of go, well, if I could just, you know, get to the point where I'm not, don't have to pick up shifts in the restaurant, or if I could just get to the point where, you know, Diner was a great thing, but it wasn't a commercial success. You know, it was sort of, you know, critically adored and subsequently cultish, you know, but definitely not like a big movie. Like, you know, yeah, I mean, Footloose was great, and then, you know, then you're like, how the fuck do I hold on to this? And, you know, I didn't.
Do you still feel that now? Do you still feel that, oh, if I could only ... Or now are you just... Do you feel comfortable with who you are? Are you ever? Has anyone... Are you ever?
I don't know if anyone's ever really comfortable with... Well, here's the thing, is I look to the future, and there's still things that I'd like to get done. Do I feel grateful and you know, proud of a lot of the places where I've gone? Absolutely. But I really don't. It's only in this kind of an instance that I do any kind of looking back. You know what I mean? I'm not a... I don't clip anything. I don't keep anything. I don't archive. I just keep going. You know what I mean? I just keep going. So, you know, in this case now, you know, I'm looking down the road to the show and hoping that the show is, you know, people like it. And then, you know, I got a couple movies in the can. I'm looking for the next one, you know.
One of my favorite movies of all time was The Big Picture, which to me, just so accurately, I mean, obviously it's satirical, but just the meat of it is so genuine for just how everything seems to work and how shitty for dumb reasons. Did you work, first of all, how was Christopher Guest to work with? And beyond that, do you feel that movie kind of represents, do you agree?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, that, first off, okay, I'll start with Christopher Guest. Christopher Guest, The Spinal Tap is my favorite movie. And was at the time. So when they sent me that movie, Chris's idea was not to cast a known actor, and certainly not as well known as I was. He didn't want to make it with a famous actor. He didn't want the budget to be there. You know, he I think when you look down the line at his films, as amazing as that company is that he uses, you know what I mean, and as well known as they all are kind of individually, and you really recognize them, he doesn't build movies around stars, you know. And so when I read that script, I was like, I gotta be in this fucking movie. I love this movie. He was resistant, you know. I really had to talk him into you know, letting me come on board. I felt like it was so true and so funny, and I'm constantly still to this day, and I haven't seen it since I made it, remembering things that come up all the time. You know what I mean? I'm when Marty goes, I don't know you, I don't know your work, but I think you're very talented. You know what I mean? It's like, I just can't. That happens all the time. You know what I mean? My other great line is, oh, you're a director? Jimmy, our busboy's a director. I mean, if you go to, you know, I hate to say Hollywood, that is just, you're going to get that. Day in and day out.
Yeah. I love it's such a beautiful joke that you don't see coming when you're meeting with the apartment manager and he goes, he's talking about a movie about an actor and he goes, that was Red Reardon's first picture. I made that guy a star, a big star, and then he turned around and crapped in my face. Literally. Just adding literally to the end. It's such a gorgeous joke.
I know, for those of you who haven't seen it, my God, that is it. I'm the straight man, so I'm not patting myself on the back when I say it's a funny movie, because that is a funny, funny movie. And so true. I mean, so frighteningly true. And interesting, I'll tell you something interesting that happened with that movie was that the studio, which was, I believe, Columbia Pictures at the time, it was real art imitating life. Because life imitating art? Life imitating art. Because what happened was the head of the studio that greenlit the movie was a guy named, I think his name was David Putnam. Maybe. Is that who it was? David? He was a British guy who had gotten this. He had produced sort of more artsy sort of British movies, and then got this job running this giant studio. In the course of us shooting it, he lost the gig and was replaced by Dawn Steele, which is exactly what happens in The Big Picture. And she hated the movie. She literally said to me, I don't know why you did this movie. What's good about this? Why did you do this?
Well, first of all, I'm a human being, and that's rude.
And so she dumped it. You know, they barely released it. Didn't buy any ads in certain places, just put it on a screen, and you know, didn't find a way to, you know, whatever you do with a movie like that, you know, market it, you know. So it was a real, you know, a real case of reflection.
I still, now just all these lines are coming with Dan Schneider's special condolences go out to Jimmy Delvecchio, special effects man extraordinaire, regrettably killed on the set of Cross Sabers of Truth. Like the student film, like the pretentious student film awards. It's like every one of those guys. Like, oh, I know that guy. Oh, I know that guy too. It just, it's such a gorgeous movie.
Yeah, it's a goodie. I'd like to go back and watch it one of these days.
Do you ever watch, can you watch your stuff or do you not?
I don't really watch my stuff. I'm not quite sure why.
Well, you've missed some really great movies.
No, I watch them when they first come out.
Okay,
sure.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I usually like to watch them twice. The first time I watch something, I need to be, obviously I couldn't do this when I was, you know, starting out, but now I need to be sort of like safe and alone and maybe just with Kira and just watch it. And then I like to see it with an audience just to kind of, you know, see what that experience is like.
Yeah.
So I haven't, but I don't, aside from that, I don't really go back. Once in a while you get a, one of those things where they put together like a clip reel or something, you know, and you get to see certain scenes and stuff like that, and that's always kind of fun because then you don't have to sit through the whole thing.
What's what can you even name, like, a favorite movie that you've worked on?
I don't have really favorite movies, but I would say that in terms of performances that I seem to remember liking, Murder in the First was one. Mm-hmm. Even though I wasn't really in it that much, JFK, The Woodsman.
The Woodsman's great.
Thanks. Yeah. Taking Chance, you know, was the HBO thing I did recently. You know, I one of my favorite things that I ever did was probably the thing that is the least seen, which was a great playwright named Lanford Wilson, who died recently, and he wrote a play called Lemon Sky, and it was being done off-Broadway with Jeff Daniels, and one of the parts was played by Cynthia Nixon, and they decided to do a PBS American Playhouse. It was like a I don't know if American Place is still on, but they would sometimes film theater, you know. And Jeff didn't want to do it, and Cynthia Nixon didn't want to do it. So I took the part that Jeff had done, and Kira took the part that Cynthia was doing.
Oh, that's awesome.
So we sort of, like, have them to thank for, you know, being married. And we didn't really play opposite each other. I think we were, like, stepsisters.
Oh, that's where you guys met.
Yeah, that's where we met, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And, but that's a another story. But just in terms of, like, a difficult and complex kind of performance, I think that was a good one.
How have you managed, just looking around your trailer, there's just pictures of your family and pictures of your wife and pictures of your dog. Like, it's
and
a really,
dogs,
it's
yeah.
a nice, it's just like a nice warm, I don't know, it's, I mean, like, literally collages everywhere. How do you, I think a lot of people would love to know, how do you keep a relationship fresh? How do you, you know, like,
I don't know.
Especially doing what you guys do, like, it's...
Yeah, it's really, I wish I knew the answer to that question.
It just works.
Yeah, it just works. I mean, I think, you know, if you're lucky, you find somebody that you're, you know, that you have a good time with, you know. And then, you know, then you just have to also try to prioritize, as we were talking about before, you know, to try to make something more important than your own legend, you know, and like that.
That's kind of that's an interestingly selfless point of view for a performer, where I feel like most of the time, you know, performers. Oh, yes, yeah. Hey, buddy.
What?
I'm doing an interview.
Yeah. This is Marcus. This is our
hey, how's it going?
Amazing
Chris.
Hi Chris.
Nice to meet you.
Director.
Nice to meet you.
Producer of The Following.
Which
this is this
awesome podcast.
No, dude, I know it. Dude.
What?
Fucking Chris Hardwick's in
it. Come on, stop it.
Are you kidding?
Stop it.
Can he join in?
Yeah, sit down.
I was a PA at MTV.
When Are you
doing,
serious?
We were doing Singled Out.
So. Holy shit.
Yeah.
You were at MTV? You worked at MTV?
I did. I worked on, as a PA on, like, remote control.
Oh, my God.
I had a cubicle at 1515 where TRL ended up being.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Co-directed the pilot.
Which was great. It's such an amazing concept for, I want to talk about it, but I don't want to spoil too much, but just the sort of, the puppeteering that happens is, you totally don't see that coming. You're watching, you go, oh, I think I get what this is, and then it takes a turn, you're like, what, fuck, you're like, and it happens in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, well, wait, I just literally landed from LA, I was editing, and, did a marathon. I made some changes in the pilot to bring it down to time, and then I watched 2 and 3 and 4, and I found myself going, holy fuck.
he directed 2 and is, you know, kind of oversees everything and is going to do at least another couple more this season.
That's awesome.
One right now
he's directing one right now.
Well, congratulations for digging yourself out of the MTV trenches. Not everyone gets out.
Well, yeah, it was good. I fucking loved it, man. I loved being over there.
That's good. Well, you guys, but the PAs at MTV, I felt like had the worst deal because MTV, there was, you know, there were a bunch of people in charge and then everyone else had to do everything.
Yeah.
And it was like, if you were mildly good at your job, that was a bad thing to show them because then they would just, it was like, they were like a lamprey. They would just attach.
I got really lucky. I was a PA there, but I met this girl there who was also a PA, and she's like, I quit. I'm going to go be a nanny. And she went to become Nora Ephron's nanny.
Oh, wow.
And I, through dating her, would go over to Nora's house, and then we became friends, and she became my mentor.
So then you could break up with the girl and just move
then
on to
we,
the...
We broke, we ended up breaking up, and I ended up basically living with Nora Ephron and Nick Pileggi, and that was my film school.
Whoa, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was fucking great.
So, wow.
Yeah, you know, no complaints.
That was like a sexually transmitted mentorship. Which I recommend, if anyone can make that happen.
Awesome. Out of all the STDs.
You sort of fucked your way to the top, which is a very hard thing for a guy to do.
Yeah, that's true, but I did it.
That's
now
awesome.
Fucking Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
What? What a huge reveal for this.
Daily.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's awesome. It's good to see you.
I was like, where is he? And he's like, I think he's done. I was like, all right, I'll check.
Oh yeah, we're gonna wrap it up in a sec. I was just about to. I'm glad it's good you came in because I actually want to talk about the show a little bit. The point when you came in, I was talking about how, you know, talking to Kevin about, you know, just his relationship and, you know, like just building something that's bigger than yourself. And I was saying, well, that's an amazingly selfless point of view for an actor, because a performer's, I feel like there's a degree of, like, we have to be really selfish because we always have to be focused on our own thing and trying to, you know, get ahead. So I think finding that balance is not something most people can do. My dad always was like, yeah, relationship. It's hard to have a relationship and a career. You kind of get one or the other.
Yeah.
But I always hoped that wasn't true.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it works for some people and some people don't. I don't really have the answers, you know, I mean, to that. I think that, you know, one of the things that, which we sort of touched on before, that, you know, it's hard as a film or television actor to not get completely self-involved, you know. I mean, you're self-involved anyway if you become an actor.
Yeah.
You're the person that walks into the room and, you know, wants everybody to look at you. You know what I mean? I felt like that from the time I was, you know, 2, 3, I remember going, I hope everyone's going to look at me. You know? that's just the way, that's part of the personality. But I think that when you do a scene, you try to make a connection with another actor. And a lot of times in the course of doing the scene, as you get more and more coverage, just from a physical standpoint, there's more and more garbage in between you and the actor that you're trying to connect to.
Sure.
And eventually people will say, don't even look at him. Look at this little mark here on the side of the map box. And you start to, or the cinematographer, you know, it really looks a little better when you just tilt your head just like that. And you start to get very, very hyper self-involved. And the thing you always have to remember, I find, which kind of goes back to theater, is that you have to play the play. You know what I mean? You have to deliver your piece of what the overall story is going to be, and not get too wrapped up with just looking out for number one, which means that you have to engage the other people who are in the scene with you and the other cast members, and make sure that all, and you've seen from the pilot that, you know, that's the meat of the show, is all these other crazy kind of stories that are going on surrounding this guy. And that's a tough thing to try to accomplish and to remember, especially since television and film, you know, we talked about that brotherhood thing that I was, you know, sort of pining for.
Yeah.
It's incredibly hierarchical. You know what I mean? It's like they refer to you as number one, or number two, or number 25, or whatever.
Whatever list of the call sheet.
Yeah, I've seen people out with fucking tape measures, you know, measuring each other's trailers. To actually get back to the idea that we have, you know, an overall piece of work that we have to, you know, deliver is a tough thing to try to remember, and it includes everything from the bigger picture to just really, really connecting with the actors and listening to the people that you're acting with.
Particularly in this show, where the actors have to be. We're a television show. Everyone wants everyone to look pretty and look good, and I'm constantly pushing for everyone to look. Ryan Hardy's been awake for, 5 days in a row, so we don't clean him up so much. So you have to be a little you have to be willing to go there as an actor.
Sure.
And even the last thing we did on Friday, where I'm asking you to go to a car and break down emotionally, and there's nobody there to do it with except, you know, my crew
in the car.
And a car, and the crew's tired, and everyone's like, you know, let's just get this night over with, and I need Kevin to go and break down and have an emotional moment, and there's a million people staring at you from this far away, and the fact that he can pull that off and stay focused is amazing. We, you know, every day.
This guy's like Teamster standing there chewing gum, like, hey,
Cry, cry, cry.
Yeah. Or people just literally like doing this, you know, on their Blackberries iPhones, like texting. And I'm constantly going, just guys, he's trying to work.
Yeah.
Back off, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's hard, man. I have a tremendous respect for what these guys do every day. And it's why you call them number one, number two, because there's a lot riding on those moments.
Yeah.
You know, and if those moments don't work, the show doesn't work.
Well, I hope people watch the show. I know it's mid-season, which is good, because I think networks tend to give mid-season shows a little bit more of a chance than what happens now, which is like in the fall, 2 episodes, gone. You know, like they don't give anything a chance. So if people get to watch the show, I want to make sure that they watch all the way through, because it starts out and I think you go, oh, this is sort of like an SVU kind of and it's not at all. So I really want people to give the show a shot.
I don't know if you've touched on it, but we have the luxury also, we're not being preempted.
Yeah.
Any show that premiered on Fox in the fall, starting this week, they're shutting down for 4 weeks because of baseball.
Oh, right.
So you're not going to get a chance to see the consecutive episodes. We're going to run 15 episodes every Monday night. You know, it's appointment television. So it's like a cable show.
This is a weird time of year to have any kind of television show. Like, say you got baseball, you got the election, like everything. Yeah, like, there's really nothing. They might as well not had a fall season this year.
It was a big consideration we'll see in 2013. For us. When they were like, we'll put you on in January, we're like, thank God.
Yeah.
You know, because everything will be done with. We'll get the benefit of advertising on baseball and football and... Then when we hit, and then you're just gonna watch every Monday.
That's great.
Cool. It goes crazy places, man. Wait, hold on to your hat. I mean,
I'm gonna go out and get a hat.
Yeah.
Can I borrow your hat, Mandy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks. I like your hat. It's very
Annie Hall.
It is very Annie Hall.
It's Thank nice. You.
I assume you need to steal Kevin back because.
Sorry, I do.
No, please. You gave us an hour, and it was really cool, man. Thanks for having us in your trailer. It was good talking to you.
Fun talking to you.
And and good luck with the following. And it was so nice to meet you too. That's such a. Oh, I just feel like you talk about the brotherhood of like, oh, we fucking made it through MTV. It just feels like feels like we served together or something. Like, oh, we fucking got out of it.
Yeah.
We didn't get ground into nubs.
No, I think it was a great learning ground.
Yeah.
It was a good place to start.
Cool. Well, good to see you guys. And enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.